Welcome to another episode of Anam Outfit Podcast. In this episode, we spoke to Hardik Pandya, a product designer at Google, about the hiring process at Google, how the interview works at Google when hiring for designers, how he prepared his portfolio, and how he builds up a business case for design. And today we're going to talk about like all the questions that you sent us on Instagram and whatever live topic that you come up with. Just for a very quick introduction, Hardik and I met in InstaMojo together. We worked there for about a year or two. Later on, Hardik worked with Ola, and then now he's working with Google Search. And if you haven't already, check out his interview on my YouTube channel, where you can learn about his career, his journey, and his learnings. And today we're going to extend that conversation by taking your questions and the one you sent us already, and the one you share with us here. So what's happening, Hardik? What's up?
Good man. Enjoying the quarantine life, basically. I was actually planning to take the call from outdoors, and turns out it's heavy raining, and the network is not as ideal from outside. So, but finally, happy to have joined.
Right. Awesome. So what we're going to do is get started with the questions. Yeah, a lot of people are joining. Siddharth, your energy is always on top notch. Hey, thanks. You can start, in case you have not already submitted your question for Hardik, you can post it on the chat here. You can always use the questions option here so we can see it later. There's a question option right next to the comment box that you may see. So you can use that and submit a question and we'll pick it up. So Hardik, we're going to start with the first one that surfaced a lot. The most common theme of question is how were you able to get into Google? What is Google's hiring process like, especially for designers? And is a portfolio necessary? And if I'm looking to get into Google, like how do I approach my career?
Yeah, so I'll share a little bit of a history here, right? I think right after Ola, I actually was realizing that I had amassed a lot of body of work, a healthy bit of work, but I did not really have any record of it, right? And that was becoming problematic, not for Google or anything, just in general, right? So I wanted to document all of that. And from all the notes and all the saved files and mocks that I had, I basically started like documenting a story. And at the same time, a friend of ours, right, had already joined Google for a while, and there was an opening in the Bangalore office and she wanted to refer me. So I basically took that opportunity as another sort of accelerant for me to finish my portfolio, which was already sort of in flight. So I spent 4 months just working on the portfolio, right? And wanted to do it right. Wanted to like give it the justice that it deserved, right? Like after all the work that we had done together, it needed to sort of come out as in its authenticity, right? About how deep we had gone, how rigorous we had been, and all of that. So to capture all that, it took its time. But after four odd months, I had something that I was satisfied with, and that started the conversation at Google, right? Even with a referral. Having a portfolio for an interaction design position, or even a visual design, if you are going for that, it's a non-starter for even a conversation with the company if you don't have a portfolio. So me having finished that in time, right, actually was quite helpful.
Right.
And basically what happens is people like to meet you unless they know that they are going to have a fruitful conversation, especially in a hiring context, right? Right. So they want to ensure that you meet a certain level of quality bar before they even engage in a conversation, because every step of conversation that the company has with you is expensive, right? Both for them, for you, time-wise and money-wise, right? So so that is a door opener. Basically, having a good portfolio is just how you get in. So yeah, I think it all started there. And speaking about the Google recruitment process, it lasted for months, definitely more than a month. And I know of many people who for who the process lasted for even like over 6 months. So to say that it's slow and it's very purposeful is an understatement, right? It's extremely rigorous. It basically tests every single aspect you have, and you would have multiple doubts along the way, right? It has about 8 or 9 rounds of basically vetting, and every single one of them is meaningfully designed to test a specific comes to being a designer. So it's not just about your core skills. It's about how good of a communicator you are, how good of a collaborator you are, how good do you empathize, right? How well do you empathize with others and others' skills and others' jobs and others' fields, right? So it puts you through all of that. And I wouldn't say it's perfect now, having seen the process from the other side of the table, right? Like, I wouldn't say that it's perfect, but it definitely is one of the best in the market market for a reason, right? And sometimes, like, you can argue about efficiency versus like speed, right? Like, how good you want to be versus how fast you want to be in hiring. But I think the process is currently at the right side of the equilibrium, right? Like, it does, I mean, hiring slow is never the wrong idea in general, right? Like, in the hindsight, I mean, that's why it ends up sort of keeping that bar where it is, right? So that's basically been my experience. Specifically about like the 8 or 9 rounds, I would say that there's a call interview over phone with somebody completely like a random designer from anywhere in the world. After that, there's like portfolio screening. Portfolio screening happens. After that, there is a design exercise. The design exercise is vetted. And once the design exercise is vetted, you sort of enter the funnel, right? Like from where it is all about the conversations you have with the people. Right. So then it's about 5 or 6 rounds of in-person interviews with researchers, product managers, engineers, right? Front-end engineers, mostly TLMs, other designers, a senior design lead or a design manager. And then it's sort of like a collective feedback from all of them that ends up guiding the decision.
Right.
So it's a lot of manual work involved. I was lucky enough to have like my 5 or 6 interviews scheduled on the same day. Not easy, but trust me, you want them all done in a day instead of having them spread out over like multiple weeks.
Right.
Having them in a day is definitely, looking back, the better idea between the two.
But wouldn't you get exhausted by the end, like on that day? Like,
I was. I mean, I remember. So my interviews were in Bangalore. Old Madras Road is where the office is, and I lived in HSR layout, right? So the interview started at 10. Right. I had horribly miscalculated my traffic and commute.
Right.
So I was like, literally, I reached there like 2 minutes before the first interview was supposed to start.
Right.
Thankfully, they had kept a 30-minute buffer, knowing that you could potentially get late. So eventually the process started at 10:30, which was great because I needed to calm down, right?
Right.
I didn't want to go into a frenzy.
Right.
All of that ended on the same day at like 6.
Right.
I remember like completely like devoid of any energy left at the end of the day. Basically, I was like knocked out, right? I remember the ride back home was, I think I just slept off in the cab ride back home. I had like nothing left in the tank, completely spent.
I can imagine.
Full. I think I had a great experience. It was fun. I had a great lunch with my potential future teammates. Didn't know that back then, but yeah, it definitely also then depends on like what kind of interviewers you get from what region of the world, right? Like sometimes you get somebody from Poland, like I did. You have a hard time communicating because they sort of, there's an accent involved, that people in interview styles are different, the communication styles are different, you have to sometimes repeat yourself. It all basically is a game of variables, man. So there's definitely a little bit of luck involved in the specifics of the situation, but Google tries to sort of randomize enough that that seems to get averaged out along the length of your individual process. So like if you get like 1 or 2 bad experiences, that won't end up defining your outcome. So yeah.
Right. And, you know, just to dig in a little bit deeper, I want to like talk to you more about portfolio as well. But before that, like, you know, the questions and the conversation during the interview at Google, were they like similar kind of question that you, you know, you get asked in regular design interviews, or are like, is the same question, but they dig in deeper, they question more, like, does it differ a lot, or is it just same conversation over and over, you know, similar kind of questions, but multiple rounds?
Yeah, so I think the planning committee basically decides the interviewers in a list, and they all ensure that every one of the interviews is about a different thing. Okay. So if you, in a conversation, if you are sort of basically trying to like veer off the trajectory of like the core skills or the questions that they are trying to test, they do keep trying to sort of bring you back to the track. So they always sort of nudge you in the direction where they want you to go into, in order to like clearly set you up for like answering exactly their question, not something else. Right. So it's all like there is not a lot of overlap between the kind of questions you get asked in the interview. So you may think that six interviews must get repetitive at some point, right? They largely don't, apart from like some common questions, right? Which is literally like 5 minutes in a 45 minute conversation. So other 40 minutes, you would end up discussing something very exclusive to that person and to that skill.
Right.
So that way, like it does remain very fresh in terms of what kind of things you discuss with the next person, right? So for example, with an engineer, you would not talk about stuff that you would talk about with a researcher. Like they're extremely different. Also with like designer to designer, they would try to test you against different skills, right? Sometimes you talk about like managing collaboration. Sometimes you talk about like simply like pure execution and like driving things and taking ownership and things like that. So that's how like the conversations differ.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, this is also where like it gets tricky, right? Like sometimes a person interviewing you is expecting certain things, but like also has a different interview style, which is what I meant when I said like personalities matter a lot. Right. So, so like if they are expecting X, Y, and Z, and you are talking about whatever U, E, and W, then you are slightly off, but they are not allowed to give you a hint, which means like the calibration doesn't happen. It could factor into the score that they rate you with. Right. So all of those always you know, come into play. But I mean, as I said, right, like it still tries to do the best it can, the process itself.
Very interesting. And specifically speaking about in a portfolio, a lot of designers struggle with that. You know, like, where do I start? How many case studies should I have? While we have planned another, maybe a roundtable or a specific conversation about portfolios, maybe even a YouTube live we should do next time. But very briefly to touch upon, like, how many case studies are ideal? To what details should you, you know, should you flesh it out? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I have been doing this 30-minute sessions with a lot of designers by opening the calendar up, right? And most of the sessions end up turning about into like portfolio reviews, basically. So I've done a lot of these and I have like some fresh feedback on top of my head about this. So basically what I see is a lot of people put many case studies in their portfolio. They try to show breadth, right? And which is totally fair. I think showing breadth is important, but it's only one of the signals that the recruiters look for. The other even more important signal that recruiters look for is depth. And people don't often optimize for depth as much as they do for breadth. So having 10 projects is great. Having 5 projects with 3 with very intense deep dives is much better, right? And you have to do that self-curation and decide which projects do you want to like really dive deep into, where do you have a lot of material and content, and pick at least 2 or 3 of them that actually go into much more depth that you can have a 40, 45 minute to an hour conversation about, right? You should have that that level of material for those two, and not just in your head, right? Like you need to put it out there so that the depth comes across. What Google optimizes for always is not how much work you've done, but how rigorous you are and how in-depth you have gone in whatever you have done. You may have only shipped a certain screen or a single flow in an app, but if you have been really rigorous, probably that's what it takes, right? So that's something that I learned over time, also recruiting and also interviewing for Google, right? Like when I interview on behalf of Google and I look at other portfolios, this is what I look for. So I would say about 5 projects is a really decent portfolio. Having 2 or 3 of them go into really deep dives. And then specifically speaking about individual projects, I really get irritated when I see portfolios that have like a homepage with a lot of projects, but no names on them and on titles or the titles, actually see what the project is about, right? Like just be upfront, right? Like no recruiter has time to go through your the interaction program. Just follow like the same, like nobody's judging you on how your portfolio is. They are judging you on how your case study is, right? So pick a simple theme, have an upfront title, have an upfront 1-line, 2-line description of what the project is about so that there is enough for me to click on it, right? And then I go into the detail. And this is, it sounds big, right? But not a lot of portfolios I see follow something like this. And do self-curation, right? Like if you have 15 projects, don't put them in a laundry list, right? Like put 3 or 4 of them at the top, which are like, hey, some of my most recent work or some of my most interesting projects, and put the other ones away, right? Like, or under a different title, right? Like, if there is no curation, I don't know which ones are projects that you are sort of advertising on your behalf, right? On your portfolio. So that level of self-curation does matter a lot. Right. And then speaking about the specific case studies, right? I really like when people actually start with like a clear problem statement at the top, right? In a layman's term, right? What happens is many times people work in domains where that are not as sort of obvious to other people who are just passers-by, right? Like the recruiter is a passers-by. They just look at the website. They want to like skim through and get like an idea of what kind of problem you solved. They don't know what banking sector you worked in, what kind of challenges your banking startup faced, right? So write in layman's term the problem statement. Right, so that I can understand, okay, this is the problem you're trying to solve. Fine, I empathize with that. Let me dive deeper, right? The simpler language you use, the better it is, right? And the more block quotes you use, the more block quotes and the more like call out sections you use, they are the only ones that I'm probably going to read as a recruiter, right? Like I am, what I'm looking for is like not to have to read paragraphs to actually know how the story is flowing. Like just give me like the snippets that are enough for me to get the gist of like the entire story. So like use your titles smartly, use your headings smartly, use your block quotes smartly. So like every title should flow into like a story, defining the problem, understanding the context, open questions, conducting research, trying out different variations, user testing, finalizing the mocks, shipping or collaborating with the eng. These are like all the titles that I love to read, right? Like whenever I see it all flows in nicely. When you use obscure titles that are not from the industry or that are not widely used, nobody has time to sit down and make sense of it all, right? Like they only have about 5-10 minutes per portfolio to make a decision about whether this goes through the funnel or not. So in order to like, you basically converting, right? Like, so you basically converting in that 5-minute window, a decision in your favor.
Right.
So like lay it out like that. And then the other thing about mocks is, people like write all kinds of long stories and then don't end up showing the final outcome at all, right? Like why is your story 3.5-folds long and then the mocks you end up showing are only 3 or 4 visual mocks? Where are the rest of them, right? So the smart way to approach this would be like if you redesign the whole app, pick a flow, right? Like just lay out the context at the top for the entire app. Right. But when you're writing a case study, you probably don't need to write the case study about the entire app. You can just define like all your user journeys that you solved across the app, pick the 1 or 2 of them, go really deep into 1 or 2 of them, right? This is what I did in the Ola case study as well, right? Like the ride booking app or the ride fulfillment app on the driver app. That's like the 80% of what the driver does on the app, right? Any of the other journeys are not as important, right? I mean, they're important, but they're not mission critical. The mission critical is the driver being able to fulfill the ride. So I focus just on that and the entire page is just on that. Right, so that allows me to have a deeper sort of that allows me to go deep on a single flow and show like the depth, right? And then I can have like other flows at the end, but it's all about like showing that depth per flow. So that's one like good way to deal with it, right? Like to deal with really like to address the concerns of like, oh, were you rigorous? Were you deep? Like, did you really go down solving the problem in multiple ways and like land on one? Like you can't do it across like 50 flows that your app is probably going to have. I don't want to see your settings screen, right? Like I don't want to see your profile. I don't want to see your login screens. Like I don't understand why people show login screens, right? Unless login is like the product that you are
trying. Something innovative you did there, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, these days you don't need to even reinvent any of those flows, right? Like forget password flow. Like I don't want to see those screens. I don't want to see your settings. I don't want to see your account details page, right? Like show me the hero flow, right? Like what is the hero flow in your app? Pick that, go into depth, and that's about it.
Right.
So yeah, these are like some of my observations on portfolios.
Very useful. I think that's going to help a ton of folks because I keep getting these questions as well. And been planning to do live portfolio reviews as well. Maybe that's what we should. And I've spoken about it twice so far on Instagram Live, and people here must be like, he never does it. But it's just been trying to figure out a format. So maybe we should, you know, what I'm going to do is send out a Google form on Twitter and on Instagram, and then ask you to submit portfolios. So maybe me, Hardik, and me and some of the designers can get together and do a live portfolio review on YouTube. So let me know in comments here if that is that is an idea you would be interested in. That is a format that I've thought of. So if that sounds useful, please let me know. So the next thing that keeps coming up, another pattern that I saw is a lot of design. A lot of folks, students who are not yet sure about design as a career. Right. What are the possibilities? Should they consider it? Is this a right career for them or not? That seems to be the bigger, the most specific question in there. That is this right for me? So, how did you realize, that this was right for you, or design was right for you, and that's what you want to pursue? And what kind of signals can people use to, figure this journey?
Yeah, it's a two-part system, right? You want to sort of start doing something, and then you want to see the benefits of it. You want to see some feedback from the industry, or like from the community, right? To know that you're actually doing something good, right? So or you're on the right track. So it is twofold, and how I did it was get really hands-on really early, right? People talk about like whether it's the right thing for me to pursue or not. It all depends on how good you get at your hard skills as early as possible. Like without the hard skills, there is no conversation, or there is no basically evidence that you can even make a career in it, right? So in order to realize if you can make a career in it, you really need to get your hands dirty, pick a tool, any tool that you like, right? Sketch, Figma, whatever is your, whatever is your jam. Start like designing, right? Start designing screens, start designing like interfaces, and reimagining things in your own way, right? If they are good, you would get feedback. If they are bad, you would still get feedback. But that whatever feedback you get is valuable in helping you make that decision for yourself, because nobody else can. People can only nudge you in that direction, but ultimately you have to test whether you really love doing it and whether you are good at it, right? So it basically is both those things. And a lot of times when people ask me this question and they show me their work, what is lacking is the hard skills, right? And which is why it's very difficult to judge whether they would be able to like sort of go forward with pursuing their career in design or not, if they are not willing to put the time in getting better at the hard skills. So it's about both things, right? Like you would not even have this as an option if you don't put the time in getting better. Right. And hence there is no conversation. Right. So it's like, follow, like there's lots of tutorials to get better at hard skills. The good thing about getting better at hard skills is that the only thing it asks for is the end time, right? There is no gatekeeping. There is no sort of other secret sauce, right? Like if you put enough time, which is how I did it in 2013, 2014, when I was picking up Sketch, and it made things easy for me. I started like making screens in Sketch. That's how I got confidence that yes, I think I can design screens, and that's how I can sort of now all that was lacking was like everything around it, right? But if the core isn't there, then there is nothing around it. There is nothing around it in order for that to latch onto.
Right.
So yeah, that's what I would say, right? Like and the good thing is students today have the luxury of time, which probably you and I didn't have in an industry that was not even there, right? So at that time when we were starting our careers,
right?
So if somebody's like 22, 23 right now, like it's a great time to, let's say, spend a year or like the final year of your college into just learning like the design tool, and like you can get really fast at it very quickly. I see a lot of students on Twitter posting really good videos and blogs and articles and like great work on even on things like Dribbble, or have like solid portfolios even before the age of 25, right? So it's all about putting time. That's really variable. Do that, pay that cost. You would realize that you either are getting good at it, or you get a great signal that you're not getting good at it, which means probably you need to explore something else. Right.
And just to add on top of that, like if you're not able to find time to invest, or like you get time but you end up not investing, then it's a clear-cut answer that maybe it's not interesting enough for you to put in the effort. Right. So put in the effort, put in the hours to get the basic skill set. And once you start seeing results, you'll automatically see the pull in that direction. And then the rest of the part becomes easier. The question or whether I'm not sure only arises when you're not given enough effort into the, the hard skills there. So now coming to the next question, I'm just going to go through the question that I collected. I have them over here. How to make sure that design you are executed, that design you've given, it gets executed well. So one of the quick answers I gave was talk to developers on Instagram at least, but I would love you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so there's a question back to that question, which is where does your well sit in the calibration of your integrity scale, right? Like fidelity scale rather. From like not there at all to like right down to the pixel perfect, like your well needs to sit somewhere in between, which already means that there is a compromise involved. And I think as you had put it nicely, Siddharth, in the last video we did, right? Like companies are leaky, like all processes are leaky, right? Every time you pass something on to somebody else, there's going to be a leak involved in terms of fidelity, in terms of the accuracy of how things get replicated into a different medium.
Right.
So if you design something in a certain tool, when it is replicated onto like a browser or like on a mobile screen in code, so it's everything is expression, right? So you express it via your XML file in Sketch versus right. you expressing it into right. let's say HTML CSS on a web page. There is going to be a certain difference because of the differences in media, right? So right. if you right. start acknowledging that, you would immediately start learning about where that well needs to sort of sit, right? Like where it needs to be calibrated down to. And it's always down to because you can't go up, right? Above 100%, right? So you would settle at something like 85%, 90%. That's what becomes your sort of average. And then you as a company need to realize, or you as a team rather, right? Like if it's a large company, every team is a monoculture. So you as a team need to set up your tolerance for sacrifice and fidelity, right? If right. you are fine with, let's say, 90% fidelity as a team, then that's your bar. And right. everybody in the team collectively puts an effort to uphold that bar. But if your team, if you are down to 70%, your own personal bar is at 90%, then it's your job to bring it up, right? Right? So you need to put in that effort, which means there are multiple ways right. possible, right? How you can do is basically, it's not about just you empathizing with engineers. I think that's something that everybody loves to say, right?
Like,
yes, you can always empathize.
Empathy. You get empathy, you get empathy, everybody
right.
gets empathy.
It's also about like, empathy, yeah, like if everybody was empathetic, we'd be running a therapy center, not a company, right? but I think it basically boils down to like recognizing cost, right? Taking something from 70% to 90% is going to incur certain amount of costs. Now the challenge is the team is used to doing things a certain way because they've always done something at they've always done everything at 70%. That means they're always fine with just paying that amount of cost
right.
and no more.
That's the trade-off they're okay with.
All their estimates.
That's the trade-off they're okay with.
Yeah, that's the estimate they're calibrating everything to, right? Like, hey, this takes this much amount of time. Hence, 70% is where we would take it. Your job is to basically realize how much further you can push it. Right now, that depends on a variety of factors, how large the team is or how big of a player in the team you are.
Right.
So once you establish credibility,
right.
once you establish enough credibility in the team, this won't happen on day one. Once you establish enough credibility in the team, you start to sort of earn that clout to be able to push that cost up,
right?
Justify that additional cost for the benefits in quality that you get. So for example, you have to find that non-linearity of like, hey, if we only pay, let's say, a week extra, worth of end resources on this, we can actually push from 70 to 95%.
Right, right.
And that's where we leave it.
Right.
Right. So and this is dependent on every project. This is dependent on people. Right. But once you get that math right, many times you would understand that probably the cost is not worth paying. Or many times you would be able to make a case study that the cost is a no-brainer to pay. Right. Because the benefits you get, not just in terms of aesthetics, I think aesthetics is one of them, but also like the fidelity, the feelings from the user, right? Like the way the product works and feels gets that much better for just a week's worth of additional effort. And I think that is a conversation started, right? So you have to start like putting it into that kind of a framework, right? Like everything incurs costs. The reason why they're pushing back is not because they don't like beautiful things. Engineers love to design beautiful things, right? It's not that they don't have the eye. I mean, sometimes they don't have the eye, but like most of the time, they also recognize a beautiful product when they see one, right? So it's about them and you having that conversation about what is acceptable and what is where you want to keep that bar as a team. Not as you, right? Like you probably, you might be horribly off in your sort of estimation, but the team is somewhere. There is a certain level that the team already has when you join a new team. It's about you thinking whether your industry demands a higher level than that, or is that like the bar that is acceptable, and anything, any cost that you can pay to further raise that bar is always a losing equation, is always not worth it.
Right, right.
Then in that case, then in that case, fine. I mean, there is no point in like further like keeping you know your guards up and just going at it.
The diminishing rate of return kicks in, and you don't get the same return for equal amount of effort you keep putting in. Because it's an exponential curve.
I mean, I was in enterprise design, right? Before joining Google Search, I was in the Google Cloud and I was designing for apps, and the entire equation of how your product went to market and how the product was sold to the customers was very different. It was all about feature parity. It was all about winning that checkbox when your sales guy goes to the customer and sells the software. Having that feature versus Microsoft's product suite basically made the difference. Doesn't matter if the product feature works better than Microsoft's or not.
Right.
Right? It's all about like, right, how much am I paying? What am I getting for it? Mm-hmm. It's very transactional. So at that time, the equation is very black and white, right? Like you pay that money, you get these features in return. All we need to ensure is that the feature ships on time so that the sales guy can put it on their expense table and then bill them for that, right? Right? So it's not about quality. It's the decision maker in a company is not the guy who has the most the aesthetical sense for the software.
Right. Or going to use it. You may never know if they're going to use it or not.
It's the CIO or the head administrator or like the head of the admin team that is making the decision. And hence, all they care for is how to minimize the costs. And how what is the cost of, let's say, onboarding the team, and what is the cost of switching? That's all they're like sort of optimizing for. So product quality is probably not even in the top 10 things that they care for. So it's, there's definitely a hard stop at a certain percentage in that kind of a product environment versus, let's say, consumer products, where everybody decides and ditches product every now and then. The cost of switching isn't as high. So you really have to capture the user and keep them, right? It's an individual's decision. So, yeah.
Right, and there you have to give more value, and it just can't be. That's where people, you know, start talking about delight. That's where they start talking about, like, you know, optimizing user experience, because you don't want that, you know, customer to go away. So you want to give more reasons to retain, and that's where you see network effects kicking in, people wanting to retain network effects to retain the customer. Coming to the next question,
I mean, it's also it's also not a zero sum game in a customer's in the consumer apps. Right, what they are doing is, every app that they add on their phone is taking attention away from your app,
right,
or dividing the use case that your app solves. Versus an enterprise, it's probably almost like they're not going to run Microsoft Office on the side as well as G Suite, right? Yes. It's a zero-sum game. You either have the contract or you don't.
Right.
So it's like once you got them, you got them for a considerable amount of time. So you bought yourself that runway. But with the customer, right, like they don't give you second chances, right? Like with consumers. So it's a very different thinking that's required there.
Right. And that also changes the kind of metrics you you know, have. For example, if you have somebody as an enterprise customer, chances are that at least one kind of workflow happens through you exclusively. Versus when you're a customer, let's say consumer, right, you have Netflix as well, Disney Plus as well, Hotstar as well, Amazon Prime as well. And then these companies are not talking about how many users they have, but eventually they're talking about how much time share they get out of a user's day, because after a point, you know, there's saturation and everybody has access to all sorts of stuff. So that also has changed that direction. Coming to a very, very different trajectory, and that sort of leads us to the kind of questions that we got as well, is how do you convince, you know, stakeholders, and especially in an early stage startup, to invest in design? And especially this person who was asked this question is sole designer in the startup. So that is where the question comes from. Like, how do I convince stakeholders to invest more in design?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, right? what I always recommend really young designers who are just starting out is that, although it may sound like a great opportunity to join a one-person designer company where you would be the only designer, it almost always turns out to be a losing equation, because what happens is you go with the hope of learning a lot, right? Which typically doesn't happen if you have good design peers, right? And good support within your own domain. And this is why my advice is always to join a startup where you at least have 3-4 other designers who are more senior than you are. And then you go there and you learn stuff while still having enough room in your company to grow onto bigger responsibilities. So you get the best of both, right? You get the right mentorship and you have the right career opportunities within the same company. The problem with a single person company is that it everything's on you, right? Like, first of all, you basically have to fill that entire gap of complete top to the complete bottom, communication and handling the stakeholder across all levels. So you are also replying to your CEO's request for random mocks because they have an investor presentation tomorrow, and you're also struggling to be strategic. You're also struggling to be tactical and like give your engineer the mocks that they need to start execution tomorrow, right? And at the same time, the engineers have built something and you are supposed to test that and like do a QA on it because you're the only designer, right? So it's a very, very tough space to be in. And what ends up happening is you deciding how much you want to take up, right? Like how you, I think the people who go into that kind of a job need to have an honest conversation about how much they can do and how much they won't be doing, right? Because it's just not possible to spread yourself thin doing everything. It's just not humanly possible. So I would say you either have that conversation with whoever is managing you, probably somebody like a senior product manager would be managing you at that time, right? To have an honest conversation about like, hey, what is expected out of you? Right. Are you really going to be expected to have like a lot of design opinions and like have a like seat at the senior table with like having conversations about why, if the product is moving the right direction or not? Or are you just a pure executor and they hired you because they want your app, they want their app to be designed or the product to be designed? That's all they need. Right. They have the strategy sorted, right? So once you know that, you would be able to focus on the right things, right? And then just worry about those, right? And do a great job at those. So I would not say that it's fair to assume that you're supposed to do everything. I think you can have that conversation and exactly know what is expected off of you, which is fine in the early stages of your career, right? Mm-hmm. Because you want that to be told in order to be appreciated in the company for what you bring to the table. Right. And then spread on both sides a few percentages every quarter over quarter, right? So if you are supposed to do X amount of work, do X plus 5% left and X plus 5% on the right. Basically, show some leadership, show some hands-on ownership and spread on both sides. And then progressively, you can expand your role to address those larger questions about like how my company sees design.
Right.
That's your question. I don't think that's your concern from day one or even let's say in first 6 months. Show value, show that you're useful, show that you bring thinking, and then if you're in a good company around good people, they would start recognizing what you bring to the table. And it's sort of organic, right? It's as much about what you push and it's as much about how much they pull you up as well. And I think Instagram was a great example for a lot of us back then, right? Mm-hmm. If you are ready to take ownership, it almost falls to you. Things almost fall to you because, hey, I think you are leading. There's no reason to stop you from not leading, right? Like you're already, we just need to ensure that you are not blindsided by access to information. So even if somebody is junior, but good leaders see that they're leading, they'll give that junior person the right amount of information so that the junior person can thrive.
Right.
Right. So it's all about like having that right mindset and just taking whatever ownership you have and doing a great job at it.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And the other bigger question, they'll come with their own due time, right? Mm-hmm. And you would be better equipped to answer those once you understand the company better and once the company respects you and you sort of also stand up to the incremental opportunity gains every step of the way. So, yeah. Right.
And Anirudh here agrees with you. He, being a sole designer, has taken the soul out of him. And he agrees with you that it's maybe, you know, you start to lose battles and then, you know, you run a lot of chaos. And Rahul agrees with him that, but he says that's life, bro. And Anirudh says that's the time to head out.
It's just
so there's some puns are going
it's
on.
Just good, it's not only good career advice, right? It's just good life advice. Pick fewer battles, and decide which ones do you actually want to win. Basically, you only have certain amount of energy and attention, and you would not be winning everything. Every battle that you pick, right? So once you start picking fewer battles, you start optimizing for like if I'm picking 3 out of 10 battles, I really want to win those three, mm-hmm. right? So you only put your energy where the worth is. Otherwise, right. it's a waste of time and right. leads to frustration. Yeah.
And adding to what you're talking about, you know, Instamuzu being a great example, because I've been a sole designer at Instamuzu initial phase. But coming into that project, I was very me and Sampath were very clear about what the goalpost is here. It wasn't about me being an individual contributor forever. It's about kickstarting this, getting into a place where we can start, building the team. And that's when Namrata and you also came in. Just before you, I think you guys, Vanil, was also part of the team as an intern. So it was very clear, like it was never about being the sole designer. Like we were very clear that this will take a team. This will take a village, you know, to solve this problem. So I think that sort of clarity is important. And if you haven't had that conversation with your founders, with your managers, with the senior team, this is the time to have it. Now coming to our, any book suggestions on design?
Yeah, I'm actually, I was collating a list. I saw the question yesterday on Insta Live. What I'll do is I'll send a tweet out.
Right.
I do have a list, but I need to bring that up. I haven't been able to do a lot of reading because of everything that's happening, going on in life right now, as you know, Siddharth. But I do have a list. So I'll share that on Twitter.
Maybe add that to your website. You know, like I can go to your list and I can browse.
I will do that as well. Yeah, I'll share it like a
bookshelf. You can keep adding over time.
There was a great link recently. Not recently, I think a while ago. Last year, sometime last year, I found about design books that are not about design at all. And I am really getting into that fringe content recently. That is not about design at all. I sent a tweet out like 4 months ago about reading a lot of research papers that go into the early days of interaction design and how some of the interactions we take for granted came to be.
Right? Gold mine.
There are great research papers on how drag and drop was invented, or let's say how swipe was invented, or like how, let's say, the Apple's interactions of like collecting the apps and moving them across screens, something as simple as that was invented, right? The metaphor apps have in like the modern world, in the post-iPhone world, right? Like how that came to be. It's very interesting, like going back to the first principles of why is a chip like shaped like a chip? Why is a radio button a radio button, right? Like what is the difference between a checkbox and a switch? Like very basic things like that. And that prompts you to, that opens up like your thinking to a very different era when like these interactions did not exist and they had to borrow like physical world metaphors to replicate them into digital world. So that makes sense to the average layman user who came from like a...
I seem to have some connection issues.
Did we lose you for a bit?
I think I'm back now.
I think all the people who lit Diaz are now back in their houses and hogging up Wi-Fi again.
We have some very interesting question, but before we get to the question in the chat, I have a question from Rahul here, and he apparently had reached out to you earlier, and you both could not get to talk about it. So this is the best place to start talking about it. He says we all designers are hired to solve problems, make better business, and make the product experience better. But when a designer joins the company, they realize that all the stakeholders prefer optimizing manpower and product timelines than solving actual problems of the customer. And everyone knows what's wrong in the product, but still they will live with it and, wait for somebody else to prioritize it. And unless it really hampers the business, it's not going to get a priority. And sometimes designers already have a solution ready. I have a prototype. I have to spend my personal time over that. But it will still not be picked up. There will still not be momentum behind it. What is your take on that question? How do you tackle that?
Yeah. So I faced that at Ola. I faced that at my previous stint at Google, right? Apps UX, where I was basically something as simple as designing a great spec for enterprise tables. Now, the table component that we had in Google's admin console that you see today, right? If you go to like a user list or a groups list or apps list, every table used to be different. And the table had, all of those tables had like different features and different sort of functionalities in very inconsistent ways, right? What ended up happening was a collection of two things. One was replicating basically, sorry, not replicating, but identifying like how much time it took us to maintain those tables and the discrepancies there, and to actually how much time was actually spent in like maintaining different backend APIs and how the representation was different in the front end for each one of those, and how much of that could be saved by just investing a lot of time in making the spec the same, right? So I spent a lot of time in meeting all the designers in those individual parts of the product that they worked on, and identified like what the gaps were, right? Like how different is it from where, like where we want our table spec to be. So that was a lot of my work. And then I collated all of that, created like a much better spec, like I think 3.5-4 months later, right? Like I collected every feature requirement that each one of the individual teams had, made a list of them and like created the better spec. Right. Then I collaborated with my engineer to create like a good case study for why we needed to do this. So it wasn't about just like a better user experience that you put out to the user. It's also about how much you save, how much you time and money you save internally, right? In maintaining the different code bases and the fragmented code bases. And what you do is by making it all the same, making it all consistent and like something that serves multiple requirements across multiple parts of the product, you actually create a much better case study for multiplying the effort you are putting in today for many months to come, right? So if you have a better table spec, let's say 6 months down the line, you invest 6 months worth of 1-inch effort on it, you are probably going to save, let's say, 3 years of maintenance time, right? 3 years of, and you're also going to get a lot of time back that you would have spent in maintaining fragmented code bases when you launch a new feature. So time to market decreases as well for each one of those products, right? So it's about creating that case study, right, that worked for me in my scenario. Now, this could be very different in, let's say, a different app or a different team, right? So I think one thing that helped me make peace with this when I can't change things is to learn why the things are the way they are, so that I learn and calibrate myself when things are not changeable, right? When they are changeable, you need to identify what it's going to take to change them. But when they are not changeable, you need to make sure why they are not changeable, so that you learn to analyze the opportunities differently in future. Right. So if they are not changeable for some reasons, let's say the eng manager doesn't just agree, right? Then you know it's a very individual it's an individual's position that prevents you from making that change. Versus let's say the company is just not willing to pay the cost that it would demand in order to fix something or make something better. Then you know it's a company's position. And you can try to change it. And if you try to change it, you would know how much cost it took to change it. If you can try to change it and fail, you know that probably you have no idea how much cost it requires, right? So in that case, you can either grow to learn to appreciate what costs go into changing that, like how many people's minds you would have to change, how many people would you have to convince, how much better does the solution that you have needs to be, what is that delta, right? Like what is that gain delta that it needs to be in order for somebody to be convinced about implementing it. So it's about that, right? Like you would either come out victorious by paying the cost, or you would basically realize that there is no equation, there is no exchange possible, there is no purchase possible. And then you would say, okay, fine, let's move on, right? It's a lost battle, it's a battle that you don't want to get into, and then you move on. So that's how I see it. And I'm pretty sure that even any company you may be in, not all battles are lost, right? There are definitely battles you can start winning, which then turns people to you for solutions. I saw that happening at Ola as well. Right. And what happens is like you start with a fragmented code base, you start with like a really quickly written code that doesn't support a lot, that's not written with taking a lot of feature proofness into account and all of that, right? So you're accruing a lot of debt. We talked about that. And then at some time, right, at some point, you basically are left with something that just is not extensible further for like making like that step function level advancements in your experience. The code is just not able to support it, right? So how many ways can you spin your story into justifying why that step function improvement is needed? Is it good? Is it going to open up new business opportunities? Is it going to open like basically new ways to like create new use cases that are not possible today, right? Or is it basically like a 0-to-1 improvement that you're talking about, or is it about like one taking something from 1 to 1.15? 1 to 1.15 is a whole another conversation versus 0-to-1. Like, hey, I'm actually opening up like something completely different, right? Like with Ola, what we did was like ride sharing as a flow that we built in that you can see on my portfolio. We thought about like revamping the entire driver app so that we could support ride sharing as a whole another avenue for the business, right? And you know, there was a lot of conversation already, so we didn't invent it. We facilitated that through the design. So it was a great case study into like how when you redesign an app, you could support newer businesses that are not possible before. And by doing so, you can justify the additional cost that will be required to pay in order to make that happen, right? So it's all about that, right? And I know like this is not like a specific binary answer, but it really is like that in my eyes, right? Like it's not binary at the end of the day. It's all about circumstances and what specifically is happening in your company.
Right. Using data to build a case, using ops and workflows to build a case, using other people than I do to evidences, scalability as an issue, you know, how much time we're already spending maintaining and, you know, how much it's costing the company. Gathering that sort of case and, you know, individual bits will not only help us realize that the problem statement, what it takes to change that better, what will it cost to change, but also helps us build a case where we can at least get the conversation started. Right. And
I know, like, I'm not saying anything new, right? But what I've realized is across companies, right, even in a company like Google, the problems you solve don't really change. They're the same problems. It's just the people you solve them with change. People change. The circumstances change. The market changes a little bit. Your users change. But the internal organizational problems about like, hey, nobody listens to the designer, or like nobody pays attention to like this great solution that I have.
Right.
Everybody has great solutions, right? Like probably if you talk to the PM, the product manager probably has like five different ideas in their head that they're not able to execute.
Yeah.
So people are not blocked on ideas. People are blocked on conversations, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have conversations, you will realize that your ideas have been tried before or your ideas have been explored before. Right. It's just that they probably were not the right idea at that time. Your job is to bring those up again and see if now is a better time or now is the more suitable time to bring them up. And then now is the team with changing people and changing priorities probably is a better time to execute them now. Versus if some idea doesn't work today, you can shelve that and say, let me revisit this idea in 6 months and I'll probably see if it's a better time then, right? If it's still not a better time in 6 months, try again in a year, right?
Yeah.
And that's literally how like it all comes in cycles basically.
Right. And that almost brings us to the about of our session. It's we have 6 minutes left, so we're gonna take. I'm quickly gonna take a photo with my iPad. The weirdest thing to do. Meanwhile, if any of you have quick rapid fire questions for Hardik, feel free to shoot them. And I'm gonna see that. Okay. So, I mean, gotta have an arrangement for everything, right? So, we have a lot more questions than we could cover during this time, right? And any of the questions, there are some brilliant questions here, which I would love to talk about, but all of them would, go past the Instagram deadline of 1 hour of live. So, we have 5 minutes, Hardik, if you feel like picking up any of those questions. For example, impact or design is gonna be like, a huge topic. In fact, me and Rahul and a bunch of other folks, four other speakers together had a panel discussion around measuring design specifically. If there's a quick one you want to, Hardik, pick up is the only thing we're talking about to quickly cover is how do you sell your design without sounding like a product salesman? Without sounding like a salesman.
General answer to that.
I think building a case that you talked about, is that part of it? Like, you know, what you already spoke about?
Yeah, I think definitely building a case, or like in my example, what I've done is bring user quotes, right? People love to quote users, and like if your company is light on those, putting an interaction on a slide and next to that interaction or next to that mock, if you show like how users reacted to it in pure like little words, how users reacted to it, is a slide that I get most kudos on and most like claps on, because that's the perspective nobody else most likely is able to bring into the company. PM is not going to go talk to the users. Only you have that advantage. So I think that's one way I have like had, I've tried that with battles, right? Like, hey, why should we do this? I mean, you see how users reacted to it, right? So it's a no-brainer that we go ahead and do it. I mean, I'm overly generalizing, but largely that's
brilliant. I think I'm gonna start doing some of that as well. And that truly brings us to the end of our session. And the last quick question that I really, really wanted to cover, it comes from Apoor Pandit, our good friend. And it is, what is the best thepla recipe? So do send him thepla recipe. He's looking for one. As usual.
So I can tell you this, the best theplas you can have right now are the ones you have at home. So stock up, don't hold.
Stay at home, stay safe. And I see a lot more questions coming in. We're going to probably do another live next week or whenever Hardik gets time in within the next 10 days. And then we can follow up with all these questions. Let us know in the comments what you do. What did you think about this live? And do check out Hardik's newsletter. It's on Substack. And you can follow him on Twitter. He's SV Pandya on Twitter and on Instagram. So do follow him there. He's very active on Twitter and his newsletter is amazing. You should go check it out if you haven't already. And what is the URL of your portfolio, Hardik, if you know people want to check it out?
Yeah, it's don't.design.
So don't.design is Hardik's portfolio. I love that URL. And thank you so much for joining in, folks, once again. And we're going to do more of this. And we probably will, again, like DM me right away if you guys want to participate. Just DM me your portfolio if you want to participate in the first portfolio review. We'll set it up as soon as possible and we'll go live on YouTube where we can, probably share our screen and one after the other, take two designers, give you a review of your portfolio. So there will be minimum benchmark we'll keep, for the quality so everybody can benefit from, good examples, bad examples. So it'll be curated, but please send in your portfolios and thank you so much again, once again, and have a good night. See you, folks.